Playtime, talking about playtime. Hey, everybody, we're talking about playtime today on the show. Welcome to Cannon Fodder. I'm esteemed film critic Daniel Barnes. I would never come into a show with a silly singing voice. I'm esteemed. And with me is my similarly esteemed, honestly, possibly more esteemed good friend, Corky McDonald.
I'm just steamy. Corky, that's all I am. I'm just steamy.
We call him Mick Esteemy because he's steamy. He's esteemed, and he's his name is the prefix of Mick. So he's Mick Esteemy. Corky McDonald, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm good, Dan. How about yourself, man?
Honestly, can I be real with you? Fantastic.
Okay.
Excellent.
Good.
No complaints whatsoever.
Oh God, I love hearing
that. I'm just glad that we were able to just like get real with
right
there for just 1 second, right? Because I had some things I had to get off my chest. Obviously.
You know what, Dan? Since you said that,
what's up?
I gotta say, I'm feeling the same way.
Yeah,
but probably just a scooch better.
Better than
fantastic.
Nothing wrong.
Yeah, like like ultra fantastic.
Better than perfect. Yeah. This guy. Fuck, I'm glad we were able to just like just take off the fucking veil and just like really just get down to the nitty gritty there, because obviously you and I, we had some stuff to deal with there. We put it out there.
Yeah.
We dealt with
it. We did it.
And now I feel even better than I felt coming in, and I felt pretty damn good. Corky, the show, it's called Cannon Fodder. You know, we're tearing through the cinematic canon one random selection at the time. And in recent weeks, I think we've watched some kind of heavy stuff. We got deep into Russia.
Yeah, we did.
Deep into Russia. Like, way too deep. Soviet Russia. I mean,
ooh. We got locked up in France.
It was rough. Ali Colin, Fear Eats the Soul. I mean, we dealt with racism. We dealt with ageism.
Yeah.
With all the isms.
I mean, we started this show with Yojimbo. Not Yojimbo, with Rashomon.
Man escaped. I mean, we're talking prison. Yeah. The whole thing, it's heavy, heavy, right? So the random number generator gods, the ones who determine what movie we're going to watch during every episode of our show, they decided what we really needed after all of that heaviness was a little playtime.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, just a little playtime. French auteur Jacques Tati's landmark 1967 comedy epic, Playtime, that is, dun, dun, dun. Directed, co-written, and produced by Tati, Playtime was released December 16, 1967 in France and never properly released in America. Jacques Hughes. Cinema. It was voted the 23rd greatest film of all time in the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll, up from number 43 in 2012. Yeah. It's that's a big game.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Up 20 points in the poll. This one is Playtime, and it's going out from Laura to her boyfriend Chet. And she says, Chet, I'm cheating on you. Enjoy Jacques Tati's Playtime. What the Oh my God. Corky.
Yeah.
When Orson Welles first arrived in Hollywood in 1940, I believe it was, he said that a movie set was, quote, the biggest electric train set any boy ever had. That's a great quote.
Sure.
And I think it really gets to like the idea of like movies as this place where there's a lot of possibilities. There's the possibilities of a young child at play. Anything's possible, right? You have all of this technology, you have all of these resources at your behest. I don't think anyone ever took that sense of cinema as play further than Jacques Tati with Playtime. Never has in the past, and probably never
impossible.
Will never
be duplicated.
I don't think so. Can't be done. Jacques Tati, best known for his character, Monsieur Hulot, a naive and sort of bumbling everyman, recognizable by his trademark pointed hat, overcoat, and pipe, reminiscent of like a Charlie Chaplin sort of character, but his Hulot's more subtle, he's more whimsical, and he's also kind of unassertive in a way. He doesn't really even feel like the star of his own films. And never truer than in Playtime. When he started working on this film, Tati, who again, he wrote it, he co-wrote, he directed, he starred in it, he was coming off of Mon Oncle, which was a huge international success, just enormous in France and here in America. It won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. That was also a Hulot film. So he had a ton of clout to make whatever movie he wanted to make, whatever size and scale he wanted to make it at. And you can't talk about Playtime without talking about size and scale. It was the most expensive film made in France at the time. Part of the reason, Tati built his own city.
Insane.
So like he built a set. It was a set and he kind of looked like a city. No, he built a city.
Built a city with paved roads.
So it was like a kind of a big, like a back lot where you have a, but he built a city. Right. He built a city for his movie. Buildings. There were sidewalks.
Interiors.
It's interiors, exteriors, parking meters, like the whole, he built the whole city. And then he used these immense facades of 1960s style buildings, or he used gigantic blown up photographs to create this sense of scale and depth and movement in this urban landscape, all to bring to life this really like unique vision of ultra modern life and technology in a futuristic Paris, an unrecognizable Paris. There were 365 shoot days on this movie, which is not to say this movie took a year to shoot. 365 days, separate days in which footage was shot for this movie.
And that's not counting the days where Tati waited all day to get the right light and then got distracted by some other thing he had to focus on and didn't shoot anything that day.
Exactly. And the film was shot on 70mm panoramic stock, which is like the most expensive way that you can possibly go. So the logistics of this movie are insane. But what's kind of fascinating to me is that it's in service of something that is not like nowadays movies cost like hundreds of millions of dollars, but they're also like written by AI on focus group testing. So they're destined for their own subscription services. like these movies are made money before they have a single frame has been shot of them, if a frame is ever shot of them. This is like distinctly uncommercial. This is a Hulot movie without a lot of Hulot. Okay, like think about that. Like think if they were like, okay, it's Iron Man 4, but like Iron Man's not really in it that much. Like how upset would you be? Like that's crazy. It's a Hulot movie without much Hulot. There's no story. There's no dialogue. There's no close-ups. There's not really characters or development. It's an exercise in style and whimsy and physical comedy. It's a color film with a few colors. It's a widescreen epic about confinement. This was not a movie that was made to be like, this is like Jodorowsky's Dune, for God's sakes, and like they actually fucking made it. So it's no surprise Playtime was a financial disaster, played to mixed reactions in France. American distributors refused to pick it up. Tati lost his home, he lost all his money, and the giant Tativille set that was created for this film, again, these like 6, 7, 8 blocks of a full-on urban set of his own design, demolished before the movie even came out. The great thing about a list like the Sight and Sound List Quirky that we're working on is that film scholars, unlike film critics, but film scholars don't really care if your movie was a hit.
Right.
Or if it fit a mold or met expectations or won an award or any awards or who gives a fuck. Time was kind to it because those people moved on to other things decades ago. And the people who actually care about cinema said, this is actually something special. So Quirky, my question to you, will you be kind to Playtime or are you calling a Playtime out?
Oh, gosh. Let me back up and say at the end.
Back it up. Back this thing up.
At the end of the last beep, French movie beep. We watched, which I was all fucking in on, random number generator gods bestowed upon us this whimsical 2-hour film which is almost double the length of any other film we've watched recently.
It is the longest film we've watched, yeah.
When I heard the premise, I was like, oh, the exact opposite reaction of A Man Escaped. And it, as it starts, I'm like, oh shit, this is it. This is fucking Mr. Heavyfoot. This is everything I fucking hate about this French mimery. This is, God damn it, this is Mr. Bean, but French. And Mr. Bean's all right, but you know what I'm talking about.
I getcha.
And it took me a little bit to get into the rhythm of it, to figure out what the fuck was going on and to get into it. But I had so much goddamn fun with this movie. I'm a snob comedy wise, and it's been a while since I belly laughed at a movie, and it like unforced, just like surprise, like laughter, surprised to hear laughter, actual laughter coming out of me. Oh God, it's amazing. Then when I go back and I find out what he did to make this movie, it's like Peter Jackson without the Weta Workshop behind him. It's just him doing right, exactly. It 5 decades ago. Yeah, I'm going to be very kind to Playtime. I love Playtime.
Oh, that's so good to hear. Yeah, my own personal history. I first watched this movie maybe 15, 20 years ago, and I was familiar with Hulot and Tati and all that kind of stuff. And I liked it. I was definitely impressed by it, but it also kind of baffled me a little bit. It's a lot to take in.
Buddy.
Like, you know.
We could watch it. Watch it 15 times. We could record 15 versions of this, and we'd talk about something different each time. That is not an understatement.
Oh, seriously. It's the Flaming Lips Zyreka of movies. Like, you can, like, depending on what kind of, like, how many CD players and how many fucking, like, what your system's like, this could be, like, a different movie every single time. But yeah, it's so much to take in on one viewing and on one listening.
Yeah.
Right? Because there's so much going on. But yeah, it came together for me so much this time. So much so that I'm like, damn, if I could have done my list all over again, this would be on. But I'm glad it wasn't, because then you got to see it.
My only gripe is that my LG TV, which is not a huge screen TV, doesn't do Criterion. So I had to watch it on my laptop, and I'm going to watch this again until I can see it big.
Yes. That I think for me the first time also too was I saw it on sort of a normal size TV.
Yeah.
This time I saw it on my 65-inch giant TV, and I had my headphones on too.
Oh.
So every little bit of dialogue I could put, everything that the American tourists were saying, which apparently the English language dialogue was written by Art Buchwald.
That's fucking crazy. What?
That's so funny. It's all just this nonsense chattering that is just going on, but it's really hilarious when you kind of can pinpoint certain parts of it. But yeah, it all came together for me on this one. Like, it just, every shot like vibrates.
Yeah.
Off of the screen in a way that no movie does. No movie does this. Like, it's so personal in expression. It's so simple, a lot of the comedy, and yet nothing is simple about this movie. It is the most grand, most complex, most full movie, and yet it is like there's no story whatsoever.
It is an absolute conundrum. I loved when you said it's a widescreen 70 mil shot film about confinement, and that's so perfect. It's like it's a study in these contrasts. It's a color movie that looks black and white for the first third. Very intentionally.
Yes. And apparently that was how they did that. All of those kind of like those walls and those floors, everything that has that kind of like weird sort of dull gray color. I think they like took pictures of steel and put these large blown up photographs so that it looked like metal, but didn't reflect light or create like shadow problems of things. So, yeah, I mean, the scale of this movie is absolutely bonkers. But in it, it's just like it's a very simple idea. And it's really just about like humanity versus technology, our place in this modern world, and the sort of effect that not just our technology, but our environment, like how we live, where we live, the things we surround ourselves with, how that can manipulate and pervert our humanity, sure. Right? And turn us into more machine kind of parts. That seems like this movie is like kind of like a heavy message movie. There is not a didactic bone in this film's body. I don't know that it has like a unifying theory that it's presenting, and yet it is this very life-affirming film.
Yeah.
About like humanity, like sort of finding itself in the most dehumanizing possible setting.
I looked at it in like a movie in three parts, where I looked at it like the first part that I would consider the interview at the office building and the technology showcase kind of thing is about modernity and the inevitability of technological advances and what you're losing with that. The second part was about when humans are forced to be together and technology starts failing them, in this version, that'd be the restaurant, then it becomes a party. It's fun. The life comes from actual human interaction. And then the third part is the marriage of those two things in probably the most positive way. It's kind of almost a celebration, parts of commerce, parts of travel, of technology, definitely. So it takes the first part, the second part, and then marries those together.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great point. The film can actually be broken down. Yeah, you break it down into several parts, I think, and I think you nailed it. But even going slightly more granular, there's basically six sequences in the entire film, if you think about it. There's the airport sequence, where we're first introduced to all of
our characters. I was fucking clueless.
Absolutely. We're all clueless at that point. There's the offices, where he kind of... There's the trade show. There's the apartments.
Yeah.
There's the Royal Garden, which is almost the entire second half of the movie. What an absolutely audacious fucking sequence that is. And then finally, the carousel, the traffic carousel at the end. So let's start at the airport.
Can we also you say that, six parts. And I want everybody to know that if you haven't seen this movie, there is always something in the foreground, background, midground, left to right, entering and exiting. You will follow someone. It will be an important part of it until it is absolutely not and just dropped and they just walk off and then your focus is on something else. Meanwhile, three other very important things are happening somewhere else in the scene. Every single scene. When it's not that, then it's just a beautifully composed shot with angles and colors that just filter your eye line to where they exactly need to be.
Yeah. I will say most comedies work very hard to make you do no work whatsoever. The joke is right there. I farted. There it is. Poop and fart. This, you got to find the joke in a lot of these things. And sometimes there's multiple jokes.
Yes, all seven of them.
Yeah. I will say generally, it seems really like full on first viewing. I think on second viewing, it felt like generally you're led towards a main joke that is happening. And a lot of what's happening in the background is kind of like movement and activity. But oftentimes there is a second, third, or an extra movement or something else is going on in there.
Yeah. And then the other thing is like I watch background work a lot on movies and stuff. There was never like... Like, these people all looked committed, good at it.
Oh,
like,
boy. Yeah. Now, no one... There are no background
actors. Everybody's...
In this
film. Great.
No, everyone is doing exactly what Jacques Tati told them to. Jacques Tati would start a scene with... I'm going to start you with the main... One person. Then I'm going to add one more person. Then I'm going to add one more. I mean, this was like... This is not the most efficient way to make a movie with like 100 people in every scene, to just add one person at a time. But that's how painstaking every movement is in this movie.
I had this realization. I had this realization. I was like, this is like life. This is just like, you don't know everybody's backstory or why they're at that moment in time when you go outside. You don't follow up on that. That's what life is. This movie is like that. Don't expect to know anybody's story or any follow-up what purpose they have at any location. Nothing. No.
It's all behavior. And a lot of it, again, you know, you talk about technology, but it's really as much about architecture and about our spaces and how we interact with our spaces.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you get to that Royal Garden sequence.
Okay.
But let's start back at the airport. Let's come back to the beginning. Orly Airport, which, you know, that existed. So that was like you could just go to Orly Airport and built Orly Airport. They built an airport for the movie. There's like a few shots of the exterior.
Yeah.
That last shot that's actually Orly Airport, and that's cars actually on their way to Orly. There's a handful of shots where that actually were there. But that whole interior and a lot of the exteriors where the buses are leaving.
Bananas.
That was all created for this movie. We don't really know where to focus here, right? Because there's a lot of things happening in the scene. There's a lot of background actors. But I think what we get right away is that everyone's moving almost as though by a program or as though they're on an animatronic track.
Yeah.
Everyone's moving in straight lines and they're turning at right angles. No one's moving in any sort of a curve. This is like, it's all straight lines and all of the architecture. This is this kind of like 1960s architecture where everything is just straight lines, straight vertical lines, straight horizontal lines. Nothing is, there's no Frank Gehry, like, fuck you, dude. Like, this is all straight fucking lines here, okay? That's what you have here in the airport. And then eventually, as a little bit of chaos starts to get introduced, you have these American tourists, these female American tourist group who are just constantly, they all wear flower hats.
Yeah.
They're all chattering nonsensically. Apparently, these were all military wives.
Oh, is that right?
Wives of American military serving overseas in France. They didn't have shit to do, so they were on a movie set for like 2 years. So, yeah, just absolutely crazy. And then in there is Barbara. Barbara's the only one who stands out, right? Barbara, and why does she stand out? Because she's constantly lagging behind. Mm. She's constantly straying. They're always lining these tourists up to be counted. Okay, okay, da, 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 and then you are here. Da, da, da. They're just shuttling them through. These are American tourists coming to Paris for the first time, and all they are is just like cattle being moved along. Barbara's the only one who seems to be kind of lagging behind. She's always trying to find this real Paris in this new Paris where there is no Paris. Everything looks exactly the same in this Paris, right? All we see of the real Paris is a flower seller on the street. We see a reflection
a couple times
of the Eiffel Tower and the Montmartre. And that's it. Everything else is like all these buildings, all the cars, all the people look and act and talk exactly the same. So Barbara is the one who stands out, and her sort of like her near misses with Hulot, how they constantly sort of cross path. She notices him, but they don't really talk until or have any interaction until the very end. That's the closest we have to like a story.
Yeah, it's not Sliding Doors. It's just that these two people continually miss each other until they interact a little, but that's it. Then they go their own ways.
Although Sliding Doors is a great great thing to mention because quirky. Door jokes. Oh. Does this movie have them? And if it does, if you don't like door jokes, window jokes. Door jokes and window jokes is like 3/4 of this movie, and it's fucking amazing. Yeah. Like, it's fucking amazing. The comedy here, what's great about it is that, like, again, it's very subtle, it's very whimsical. It's just like a lot of tossed off stuff just for fun.
Well, see, I think it's just subtle at the beginning, and then it especially that dinner party,
it keeps building.
Pitch absolutely perfect. It's rollicking. You know, it moved so well.
Yeah, but here it's a lot of just like silly little misunderstandings and things like that. It's pretty great. Then sound is a big thing in this movie too. We should talk about it because like there's this sense of in this like kind of urban futuristic France that he's created, like or Paris. It's so clean. Everything is so ordered. everything is so straight lines, like I said, that you have all of these really silly sounds constantly coming in. And that's like that first like sense of disorder.
It's also
kind of coming into
the way each shot is visually composed. The sound is sort of composed. Sound comes from left to right and back and forth. So you're getting little snippets of information coming at you from different conversations at different times. And when I first kind of got what the movie was doing, the first like little is when all the American women are on the bus and they're leaving the airport, but there's just a sea of cars, all the same car parked in this parking lot. Yes. And that they're just marveling about the cars. And you're hearing all the little marveling about the car. But then also the French guy trying to, you know, okay, everybody, let's get going on this trip. And it was as if like they're not celebrating anything about Paris. It's just the, you know, the homogeneousness, homogeny.
Exactly. Yeah. And that sort of keeps building into these next sequences here. So we have now the office sequence. Now, Hugh Lowe, okay, so this is the Jacques Tati character. He stands out because he's very tall, because he has this, you see his peaked hat, but also, like, it's very interesting, all the doubling going on. There's a lot of fake Hugh Lowes.
Yeah.
That are constantly like, oh, Mr. Hugh Lowe, oh, nope, wrong Hugh Lowe, or you see the reflection of a Hugh Lowe, somebody's mistaken, Hugh Lowe's mistaken for somebody else is mistaken for Hugh Lowe. There's all of this kind of like doubling
which going on. I think was kind of like a, like, you know, he's at this age, like, this is me, I'm bouncing around, but the movie kind of made me think of where Jacques Tati was at in his life and kind of like his age, looking back, like, probably knowing I've reached my top of my success. And the place I love and the place I came from is changing. Those reflections, you only see the Arc de Triomphe and Notre Dame and Eiffel Tower in reflections, right?
Yeah.
He's at this point where he's like, I don't want to be M. Hugh Lowe anymore, right? I want to do other things. So you want M. Hugh Lowe? Okay, you're going to get an English M. Hugh Lowe. You're going to get an African M. Hugh Lowe. You're going to get an American M. Hugh Lowe. And they do the walk. They wear the gimmick. Okay, you got what you wanted, people.
Yeah, no, it's pretty brilliant self commentary. So Hugh Lowe, we don't really know what he's doing. He's in Paris to have some sort of a meeting, some sort of a business meeting, but we don't really know. He's waiting in this office for this meeting. This insane office with these ridiculously long hallways.
I got real Empire vibes from Star Wars.
Yeah. This technology that does not seem convenient at all. And also this sort of omnipresent droning noise. He's brought here and then he's led into a room.
Yeah.
Which is just another big room with a lot of big windows and things like that. There's, again, we should say, like, these giant windows, these giant, very clear windows are like kind of an omnipresent joke too. Like, one of the first jokes in the movie is like a worker goes up to bum a smoke from a doorman and then doesn't realize, oh, you're behind a window. Yeah, because like it's like a literally just a giant like floor high window that is here and it's perfectly clean. So he doesn't realize, oh, you're on the other side and I need to like come around and go inside the door to get my light. So anyway, we're at the offices, this furniture, this ridiculous furniture that makes noises when you sit on it, this black furniture that we just see over and over and over again. And this is like all these like connecting threads that happen, right? So like he goes into this waiting room. He sits on this furniture, this black chair, makes a noise whenever he sits up. As he gets lost in these offices, he's led into this trade show because they're displaying furniture that is exactly the exact same chair. That's why he thinks I'm in the same office, because like it's not. It's like a trade show now that he's in. And then later, he's been into an apartment with his friend, and his friend has same the exact furniture. Same furniture in his home. It's just like the homogeneity has gone from like marketing to business to home, and it's all the same. It's all the same everywhere. And I mean,
those homes that he goes to are storefront retail looking homes, visible from the
street. That's all
they are. You don't go in there and you view it from the street as if it's a commodity.
We go there right after the trade show, and it's like they're on display even in their own homes, right? And they even appear to be, we don't hear it, but he's like demonstrating products to his friend, like just like we've been in the trade show. So anyway, we're in the office. Hugh Lowe is trying to, like, there's this constant, like, misconnection with this guy who's supposed to lead him to his appointment, but they keep missing each other. He's chasing him around the office. He encounters this sort of large area where there are these almost like cell-like cubicles, right? Like
he had it so close, he had it so right. If he could only imagine that they actually fit four people in each one of those instead of just one, right?
And that, I will tell you, that has become the identifying image of this movie is those cubicles, those
pods,
weird square pods. If you go on Google Images and search, which I did before we started the show, Jacques Tati Playtime, that's the whole first about 40 results is various shots of him looking at those pods from both from the escalator and then from the floor above. It's a very potent image, sure, and it definitely anticipated, like, kind of, where where work went. And then he just gets lost everywhere because, like, he goes to look at this map, and it's the most nonsensical map. It's just arrows pointing in every direction. So he goes to look at it, and then suddenly someone walks up next to him, hits a button, and he's in the elevator, right? And suddenly he's on the top floor. Like, everything is so modern. Like, not only are, like, the buildings indistinguishable and the people in the cars indistinguishable, it doesn't even matter, like, what the maps look like.
No.
The maps can just, like, point arrows in it. It doesn't even fucking matter. One place is just as good as the next.
One of the first, like, bits that really landed with me was the travel posters, where everywhere it's like, come to Hawaii, come to Brazil.
Yeah.
But it's the same building in each picture. Yeah. I was like, ah, I get what you're doing, you fucker.
So we go from the airport, we go to the offices, we go to the trade show. All of these chattering tourists are also at the trade show, marveling over the new gadgets and not over Notre Dame or the Eiffel Tower or Montmartre.
I mean, on the nose gag of at the trade show where they're selling all these products, there's Roman and Grecian columns that are now trash cans. Like, it's designed to look like the past, and it's just throw your rubbish in there. That's just all it's good for.
So after the trade show, he runs into, again, some more doubling. He runs into an old war buddy who he chases after, but he has to go off. But then runs into another old war buddy.
The other thing I noticed is that he's dragged into every scenario. Like,
he's not pushing
anything.
He is a leaf caught in the breeze. Like, he is either swept up in the crowd, or he is socially dominated by somebody who is just much more aggressive and loud than he is, which is kind of absurd because he's almost always the tallest
person.
He's
the biggest person.
Jacques Tati is a giant.
He has this gait where he walks like he's bounding into the next step, and yet he has to be pulled into everything.
So like I said, he sees one old war buddy, then meets another old war buddy. This is where we go to the apartment sequence, which is like a sequence of just pure design, right? Because it is it's people in their homes, but all of the homes look exactly identical. Yeah. It's like this Hollywood Squares home that are just stacked on top of each other, and everything looks exactly the same. It looks just like the offices, and they're all just like on display.
What are they all doing?
They're all just showing each other all of the new products.
Like a Bloomingdale's display. So I've been talking about how, like, it took me a while to get into the rhythm of the movie, and I you know, was trashing French mimery and stuff like that.
Sure.
Where the moment it grabbed me and I was like, oh, I'm fucking in, was the moment it's when it goes from the daytime office and trade show stuff to the night.
Yeah.
And he gets on the bus. And it's a crowded bus, and everybody's holding their poles, but he can't find a pole. And then it takes off, and a pole is loose, and he grabs it, and he just pulls it back, right? Come to find out it's a lamp stand that some guy's just holding. But it's like that gag was just so brilliantly done. And the there's a big thing about movement and transition and automotives in this movie. And it kind of like sped off into the night sequence for me. That's kind of what, and I was like, oh, you beautiful movie. I'm fucking in. So from this apartment sequence on, I was like, this is perfection.
That's the perfect headspace to be in for this sequence, the Royal Garden grand opening.
Can we also talk about, I'm sorry, can we talk about some of the gags in the apartment thing? Like, you see the people above them, you see all this from out on the street. You don't hear any of what's going on. You're watching four different playlists. Like, what was that movie where, I think it's Time Code or something?
Time Code? Yeah.
Like a good version of that.
Yeah.
So, right. The people are there's a heavier set guy and he's walking around in his living room, and as soon as that happens, Jacques Tati and his army buddy are like looking up. You know, I guess that guy's stomping around, right? The guy he's been looking for all day happens to live in the apartment right next to him.
Yes.
He passes out as soon as he gets home because he's had a shit day. When Jacques Tati actually leaves and his army buddy's family goes away, he starts taking off his clothes. The woman is all alone in now her darkened adjacent apartment. And it's like she's like everybody's watching the same show on TV. I don't know. They're watching wrestling. It's funny. It's like almost the most sophomoric brain dead programming too for you to watch on TV. But it's almost like she's watching him do a striptease for her. It's fucking great. Right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's like the jokes that... It's one thing, and then it segues completely into another thing, right? Like, they do a whole bit of, like, wait, they act like they're reacting to the show, and then they're not reacting. Like, there's one point where, like, one of the people starts taking off their shirt, and then, like, the daughter is like, get to bed. they send her away, you know? It's like...
It's like every bit is mined, and I don't know if it's the commitment to the excellency of it. It's just perfection. Like, it really is. Doesn't fall short.
No, it's physical. This is like the pinnacle of physical comedy.
Oh, and he can't even find his way out of this place because everything's got a comment. Like, he can't because the sign is in English. Like, there's a big thing like they're incorporating other languages and that you actually need a thing to tell you to push that button. Like, how much... We grew up with that, so we see push pull on everything. There was the transition time where people didn't have that, and then it went to that. They're like, "Who needs this?" You know, it's like that comment on that.
Absolutely, yeah. All right, the Royal Guard, fantastic. Quirky. This, I mean, truly, truly audacious shit. How about an hour long comedy sequence? This is the second half of the movie, and it is practically, I would say, perfect. Yeah. Practically perfect.
How about an hour-long meta in-joke about Tati having to be rushed and saying, okay, you want this shit before it's ready? This is what happens when you grab stuff before it's ready. A restaurant opening on opening night, because it has to, but it's not ready, collapses.
Yes, a very exclusive, as they say at the very beginning, this luxury restaurant having its grand opening, the Royal Garden. It's got a brand new neon sign. It's got some very striking decor. And everyone's very excited about the opening. However, it's not really finished yet. It's just not quite finished yet. However, you know, rich people are going to show up whenever the fuck they're going to show up. So they show up, and the workers now are shuttled into the back. So here's a really great class commentary where, like, we can't have any sign that, like, working class people were actually here touching things.
Right.
Like, how the fuck do you think any of this shit got built? But you can't be here. We can't look at you. We can't know that you're here. So everyone's shuttled into this back. Like, everything out front looks really like luxurious and a well-appointed. It's this giant room with a big stage and all these tables and all these fixtures and things like that. And then you go in the back and nothing's done. Like
nothing. And nothing's done. Built well either. Like this was a brilliant thing where I was like, okay, so they built this whole fucking city And it's about modernity and every, like you said, everything's clean and perfect, right? And then he had to come up with a set, or not even a set, just a building that was designed to look like it didn't work just for the gags to work. Like the lights had to go out at the right time and in the right way. Things had to break right way.
This is the most, as we very quickly find out, stupidly designed restaurant in the history of all restaurants. Right. Like nothing works, but also like fixtures are put in places that really make no sense whatsoever. Like it does not help at all. Like the bartender has giant wooden planks hanging in front of his face. That doesn't help him.
The hole that they put the food through is like a tiny little alcove.
It can't fit the tray. It's just like everything is so stupidly designed, but it's just, it looks really great on the surface, but like very quickly, as soon as humans step in there, it realizes something is very clearly. The bits just
build and build and build.
It just keeps going and going. Like it just starts with like one loose tile.
Yeah.
One loose tile. Oh, shit. Tile stuck to my foot. Go out there. Who do they send out?
Because they can't send out the worker.
Can't send out the worker, so they send out one of the waiters to go and fix the tile. And there's this great bit of physical. This is one of the foreground background comedies where the action that the worker is doing to slap the tile with the paste and slap it down and push it down is exactly the same thing that the waiter in the foreground is doing to describe what they do to the fish.
So great. It's the way we do it.
And there's so much of
that. And I love later on when they're finally just sending workers out, but now the workers come out in their denim overalls but with a jacket over it. It's not called attention to. It's just fucking great.
It's so good. I mean, and there are so many bits. Like, we could just talk about just the bits involving the door.
Oh, my God.
Just the door we could talk about. And all the many permutations of the door and what happens to the door and how there isn't a door, but who thinks there is a door and where's the door and how's the door? I mean,
and the way it gets carried into other places just because he's got the handle still with him walking around. So he's now in the coat check room.
Door itself becomes ice. Like the door, it just keeps evolving and evolving. This whole door bit. It's absolutely amazing. It really is. It's indescribable, except to say it just keeps building, building, building. And at some point, a jazz band takes the stage, and things just start to build to like a frenzy, like a real frenzy. And the bits just keep multiplying and multiplying and building until the entire restaurant starts to collapse on itself. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then there's aggressive American.
Overbearing American.
Right? Yeah, the overbearing American who is just like...
But is kind of a hero.
Buys the place. He is kind of a hero. It's kind of amazing because like as the sequence ends, it goes, you know, finally on to this drugstore. He just leaves.
Yep.
And you realize like, wow, this guy really was just insane. Like this was just a playtime for him. Like he's rich enough that he can make a city his own personal playground. If he wants to buy a fucking nightclub, fucking trash the fucking place and hire a bumbling idiot as his architect, like, yeah. And then you want to just take off in your fucking limo? Go ahead. That's the luxury of being absolutely absurdly rich.
The thing I thought was so beautiful about this party was that it builds to this. I mean, people are, the dance floor is flooded. The band is cooking. Yeah. Everybody's drinking. And then the party wanes. Like all parties, all great parties, the party starts.
Yes.
And it's.
You think it's heading towards this apocalyptic sort of end, right? But it doesn't. It evolves like a party fucking evolves, right? Like it evolves as people drop out and pop in and get drunker and
get sober. The mood changes, the music changes. Oh, it's so alive.
All right. Do you want to hear something amazing? Yeah. So I told you, 365 shoot days for this movie over the course of like 2.5 years or something like that. They shot this entire Royal Garden sequence in 7 weeks.
Really?
About 10% of those shoot days were in this Royal Garden
sequence. Fassbender would have made 3 movies in that time.
But that tells you, I mean, the challenges of shooting the other sequences, the exterior sequences, and dealing with weather and sky, clouds, whatever. But yeah, that was a kind of an amazing thing. There was an interview on Criterion. There's a lot of good extras on the Criterion.
I thought he looked considerably older at this point in the movie, and his makeup is more caked on than it was at the very beginning of the movie. So I don't know. Yeah.
This is the most Hulot that happens in this sequence, too. He comes
towards the end of the party.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's actually the kind of the inciting part with the whole door.
Oh, thing, yeah, the collapsing.
His friend saying, like, his friend says, come in, come in. He said, no. He's begging off. But again, he's being socially dominated. So he gets, ends up getting swept in. But yeah, the door smashes. And so, like, yeah, there's a whole thing of having the doorknob.
The only time I think he seeks out action is to go to talk to Barbara, sit with her at the piano.
Yeah, and so they finally have, like, an actual connection, right? So that's when the party, like we said, it breaks at dawn. They all kind of head to this drugstore. They have some drinks. The rich guy heads off. They go to a shop. You know, they're kind of walking around, him and Barbara. Hulot and Barbara are kind of chatting a little bit, having this lovely connection. And Hulot actually buys Barbara a gift as she's just about to head off with her tour group back to the Orly airport. But once again, lost in the maze of modern life, he mistakes a queue. He mistakes like a toy with all these things for the shopper queue. Has to go back and give it. He can't actually give her the present that he gets her, which is this memento of a real France. So she gets it, but then it leads to this just, I mean, the epicness of this movie really culminates in this final sequence here, this carousel of traffic, where it's just this sea of cars in concentric circles. It's absolutely, there's just bits on bits on
my
bits.
My mind
everything's
bent
bits.
At the coordination this must have taken.
Fucking
there's bicyclists weaving through the traffic. There's people running.
There's children in these shots.
And these cars
right?
are all like, going the same speed and around and around.
It's unbelievable.
Things are going up and down like a carrot. I didn't quite get what it was doing.
Someone at some point like puts a coin in a parking meter, and then suddenly that starts the calliope fucking music, and then the cars actually start moving like it's a merry-go-round. It's fucking brilliant. And she opens her presents from Hulot, and at the very bottom are these flowers, and they're shaped just like the streetlights on the road to Orly. This is this final little whimsical touch of like the natural world and the artificial world. Holy shit. It's a return to reality, right?
Yeah.
But also it's bittersweet because like we don't get to watch Playtime anymore.
Yeah. I really felt that way. I was like, I could watch this go on.
Yeah, quirky. Yeah. Let's talk about a few things. First of all, the message. I mean, I don't think there's like some kind of unifying message. What's so great about this movie is so there isn't like some kind of moment where like we kind of close in on somebody and they give a speech to explain like what this is all about, right? Because like it's easy to get lost in this movie because there isn't like, again, there aren't close-ups. There isn't dialogue. There isn't a story or characters or anything like that. So it's easy to get lost in this movie. But I think at a very simple level, it was put in a great way. I'll have to find the quote, but it was said that this movie is about the curve asserting itself against a straight line. Mm. And I think it's that simple in a way. But also it's like infinitely more complex, right? Like it's disorder versus order, nonconformity versus conformity, inclusion versus exclusion, color versus lack of color, blah, blah, blah. So it's very simple, but also I think it is very complex. And like I said, I think it's like weirdly life-affirming in those final moments.
I agree.
To kind of be like, okay, like finding the humanity and finding some sort of a connection in all of this insanity is like something really beautiful, you know? But it also has this kind of message, I think, about like, the things we surround ourselves with as people, our buildings, our technology, our cars, you know, where we are, and how that affects who we are. You know, it's just something to always kind of keep in mind, I think.
I would agree. I would agree. And I hearkened to it a little bit earlier about the cold, separate technology, inevitability, but the life affirming of being with other people and not letting the party stop even when technology fails you. And then at the end, the blending of the two, you're still going to have some problems, but you can make the best of it if you imagine it as like a carousel that you are participating in.
Exactly. I mean, playtime is so great because, like, this movie for Tati is playtime. Mm-hmm. You know, it's him finding the humor in everything.
It's his train set, man.
Here's, like, a weird comparison. So you know how in, like, video games, right? So if you go, like, through the evolution of video games, like, so Pac-Man, mm-hmm. right? Like, sort of everything's in play because there weren't that many things in play. There was just this sort of, like, diagram to go yeah. through, and then there were pellets and, like, fruits and power things. Then you move on to, like, something like Double Dragon, and some stuff's in play, but a lot of it's just stuff that's happening in the background, yeah, right? Yeah. This movie is, like, Grand Theft right. Auto, right? Everything's in fucking play. Every fucking person that you see, every vehicle that you see, everything you see on the street can be used as a weapon yeah. or like assaulted or done something to. Like, this movie is like, it's all there. This is what I said about there being, like, in every scene, hundreds of background actors, but really no background right. actors. Because it's not yeah. like anyone was told, like, as a group, hey, kind of just move in this direction yeah. and sort of like nod. You have a backpack, kind of hold your backpack like that. You know, like, no, everyone was told specifically what yeah. to do in every single moment of every single scene. There's no stars in this movie, and yet every single person that you see is the star of this movie. So that's what's kind of amazing about this. Let's talk about our favorite scenes. Do you have a favorite scene?
You know what I do? I have favorite gags. I definitely, it's weird to say that, you know, my favorite scene, it's definitely the dinner party, but it's like, that's
yes,
a big
the whole sequence, but that's, again, that's half
48, 50 minutes, right?
Yeah.
I found myself, like, every time I noticed a crown mark on someone's back, whether, you know, it's yep. firstly men in suits, and then you notice it on women's dresses, then you notice on people's yeah. skin. It's fucking, it just kept popping up in the background. It would make me chuckle every time. When the women, American tourists, come back from their long day out, their flowers on their head are all wilted. Like, everybody's flowers have wilted because they've had a long day. Just a little gag like that, man. Just so fucking. My favorite scenes were definitely in the restaurant. I loved the bit with the big fish that gets served to this couple, and it doesn't ever yes. get actually served. It gets presented, and then seasoned
about 15 times.
And then finally it's like, oh, this is not for their table. And it's even set on fire, so it's cooked. And then it's not for their table. Take it away. So good.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. Yeah, there's favorite gags. You can't really say favorite scenes because there aren't necessarily scenes. There's just like long sequences, yeah. right? You know, I would say some of my favorites, there's the, as we talked about, the kind of misconnection with this man who's supposed to lead him to where his meeting is. We don't even meet the person he's supposed right. to be meeting, but just the guy who's supposed to take him to where he's being led into this labyrinthine office building. And there's one moment where he looks across at another building that's exactly the same. And, of course, they all have these very shiny windows. And the man's behind yeah. him in the same building, but he sees him as a reflection in the other building. So he starts, like, running at him and actually goes into the completely different other building because the guy's like, hey, I'm right here. Yeah. I'm right here. He's waving, but he just runs at him.
Good.
Oh, fucking A. That was just fucking amazing. I mean, how did they do that? Yeah. You know, all just getting all of the reflections and everything in there. I love in the trade show sequence, the whole door slamming mix up. Remember, there's a fake Tati who sits at the desk,
right?
The silent doors, and he goes through it, and then someone's told about it, but then Tati's mixed up with that guy. But the scene starts with it being like, hey, sit down. Oh, can I take your coat? Oh, how about your hat? Can I light your pipe? Why don't you just go through everything? And then he's like so mad, and he storms out of the room and he slams the door, but his company makes a silent door, so it makes no noise. Like, he's trying to like punctuate his anger with this door slamming, it has no effect because of his own invention. That's great. There's a scene where it transitions to night where you just see the lights go on in one of these offices, like, which is one of the facades. It's just like a magical shot just for its own sake.
And it's so good because it doesn't go like bip, 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 up. It goes bip, 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 bip. And then it starts like four floors above and then it goes down and then it goes back up. It's it's just like the pulse.
It's amazing. And then, the whole Royal Garden sequence and the fish is what stuck out to me. But also, I think the neon sign that seems to like draw drunks into the building, which has this like weird design that has like this circular thing, and then there's an arrow going straight that points into the building. And at first, you see it, and you're like, fine. But then all these drunks keep like seeing one who gets thrown out, looks at the sign, and then immediately follows the pattern that goes right back into it. So it's just, again, it's that idea of like people and their environments. The drunks are just like, oh, an arrow telling me to go drink more? All right, sure. What the fuck? Yeah. The drunks are also the only ones who don't notice. There's not a door to go through. They just walk straight through quote-unquote glass, but all the rich snobs have to like have a fake door open.
The other thing that you said about like there's no stars, but everybody's a star, I love the brilliancy of when you have a movie with all these myriad people, literally dozens in each scene, they got to do things to stand out so you remember them. So you see this one waiter always parting his hair like he really likes himself, checking himself out. He's parting his hair to every woman he sees. There's one guy who's outside and he becomes the repository for everybody who gets like their tie dirty, their shoe messed up. And like he has to swap his out with everybody else. So that's him. Like everybody has it, or a lot of people have these like little things that you keep coming back to.
Yeah, And you're being able to locate them in the middle of all this chaos, too.
The architect, every time he's called out on his bad design, he rolls out, he's carrying his fucking drawings with him. He rolls them out to explain.
Another one I just thought about is the really drunk guy who Hugh Lowe is showing him a map of Paris.
Oh!
Like, here's how you get here. At one point, drops the map, but it's this crazy like marble design. So the drunk is just like following designs on this pillar instead. It's like, okay, so I go down here. Like,
there's a couple like workers. One was a waiter, one is a janitor, who just laugh kind of creepily after every interaction with people. They just like laugh. And it's like, what is this, a menacing statement? What is happening?
Oh, fuck. So fucking good. All right. Final thought from me. It's just something that popped up because of something my wife said. She didn't watch the movie.
Oh, okay. Had she seen it?
She hadn't seen it. She was in her room. She had working on something else. I had to watch the film. She did say, though, that every time she walked into the room or had to kind of come in or come out of the room to get something, that it was like a Wes Anderson film.
Mm, yeah.
Which I understand because Wes Anderson has like a very strong distinctive visual style. This movie has a very strong visual style as well. It just made me think like Wes Anderson also has this like very kind of strong narrative style. Mm-hmm. And a more literal voice, whereas this movie has more of a kind of a cinematic voice. It just made me wonder, what if Wes Anderson just kind of abandoned all of the kind of narrative cleverness, the nesting doll structures, the kind of like stories within stories, and just made a movie of just pure style, pure, pure style.
Right.
No characters, no Francis McDormand, no Bill Murray, just pure fucking style. So anyway, it was interesting. I would love to see Wes Anderson's.
I don't think Wes Anderson would ever make a movie that he couldn't write some clever dialogue for.
That's what I'm saying. Just pure style. Be a challenge. I would love to see it. I'd love to see it. I think his last couple of movies have come the closest to that because they're much more like anthology style stories, French Dispatch especially, but a little bit also with Asteroid City. Anyway, off the fucking topic, observations, I got them.
Eddie Cantor, any thoughts?
Eddie Cantor, very talented. There's a huge future with this kid. He can do it all. Corky.
Yeah.
Let's remind people about our rating system.
I have a final thought.
Oh, shit. You son of a bitch. You shocked me.
So I started, and when this got introduced, I kind of railed against my whole, like, Clouseau version of French
you
mime.
You railed against the
Mr.
French
Heavyfoot.
Little knowing that Peter Sellers was, in fact, not French.
What?
But British.
No.
I know. He just played.
He's not Asian?
He's not Asian either.
Blew my mind, man. Right. But I came to realize that my opinion about that had been based upon probably parodying in pop culture.
Hmm. Yeah.
About people calling out the tropes of what a master like Tati was doing. So I've never seen Mon Oncle. I've never seen Mr. M. Hulot's Holiday or any of the other ones. Mm-hmm. I was familiar with the character through secondhand parody. But I can see what was appealing about this. Like, I kept thinking of Jerry Lewis, the Bellboy. I love that movie. And it was,
yeah,
I could see them, why he was popular in France. And then I could see where you would find someone who was so precise with the directing, so precise with the comedy, so precise with just being nonverbal, but still carrying a humorous bone. So have I come fully around on the whole French mimery thing? With Tati, yes.
All right.
With Tati convert. Oui.
Tati, oui.
Would you
Marcel Marceau, non.
Would you suggest Mon Oncle?
Sorry?
Would you suggest I watch Mon Oncle?
Oh, I'd suggest you watch all the other Tati movies. I will say he only made 5 features
crazy.
Over the course of like 25, 30 years. 4 of them were Hulot movies. So Hulot's Holiday was, I believe, 51. Mon Oncle was late 50s. This was 1967. And then in the early 70s, made a film called Traffic.
So I did say I'm not going to rewatch this until I can see it on big screen. Ideally, I'd see it in a theater. So theater.
Ideally, in a theater with a 70mm
Fuck yes.
projector. But when the F is that
hey,
happening?
Hey, me and you, like, let's do
we
it.
We live in Sacramento.
Let's
I'm
fucking
sorry, man.
Organize a showing.
Let's make we'll it happen. I mean, I know the tower has a 70mm projector, so this is not an impossible
Bruh.
Thing. It's not impossible, Corky. All right, playtime. Now, first of all, the show needs to get about 20 times more popular than it is right now.
So
that's a minimum. That's conservative.
Make our dreams honestly. Come true, listeners. Share, like, subscribe. Share, like, subscribe.
We don't even care, honestly, about the likes and the subscribes. This is all about playtime,
yeah,
you guys.
Exactly.
This is all about playtime. So if you love playtime like we do, tell 100 friends about the show. A few of them are bound to like it. Oh, my God. But let's remind everyone about our rating system, Corky. Of course, we're going off the Sight and Sound
yeah.
Critics Poll, the 2022 Critics Poll. Top 250. So we make a decision. What is it a sound selection? And does it go directly into the cannon fodder canon? Or was it a little slight? And if slight, what slighted movie would we put in its place? Corky, I put the question to you, my good sir, Monsieur McDonnell. Sound or slight?
Ah, oh, oui, oui. It's in the canon. Boom, 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 boom.
You make it the boom boom. Oh my. Yes. Dieu. Pas Dieu. So yes, that's 2 for 2. I call it sound too. I call it sound as the dollar bill, baby. It is a sound, motherfucking. It is. Mm. And it's a lovely sound. I love this movie. This again, I would at this
I'm so happy I got to watch
viewing,
it. I'm so happy.
Really, really hit me. I'm so glad that you liked it. I would put this in my top 10 probably right now, top 10 or 20. So it's a magical movie, and I hope
that's
you see
the thing.
It. It's available to watch on Criterion.
I want to watch it again. I'm not going to allow myself until I can see it big.
You should watch it on a nice big screen. Again, like we said, ideally it's a 70mm projector, but we need to be 20 to 100 times more popular than we are now. We'll get there. We'll get there. But if in the meantime you get impatient, hopefully you have a very large TV, nice sound system, or some good headphones you can put on. Because, man, this movie earns it, man. This is, you want to buy a TV just to watch Playtime.
All right. So, Dan, we loved Playtime. Hopefully, next episode's movie is something we're going to love just as much. How are we going to figure this out?
Corky, we're going to have to sacrifice not all of your livestock, but a good amount of your livestock to the random number generators. They also have a website. I could just go to the free website. What, your call. Website? All right. Well, so I'm going to plug this in. I got the random numbers ready to generate.
Let's go.
I have my letterbox list, my number list ready to go. Whatever the gods give us, that's what we're doing. All right. Here we go. Beep. Number 19, Corky. Number 19.
19.
That's a, we're high up in the list.
I know.
Corky, we're up in Playtime area. And here's a movie I've never seen before. A film I've never seen before. Corky, you know, in the morning, I love a delicious Danish. With my coffee, but will I love a delicious Danish film directed by Carl Theodor Dreyer called Odette, or Odette, or Odette? I don't know how to pronounce it. I don't know Danish, but Odette, a legend for today. That's what it says. Can I read you a little something about
Odette? Oh, please do.
The three sons of devout Danish farmer Morten have widely disparate religious beliefs.
Oh, great.
When Mikkel's wife Inger goes into a difficult childbirth, everyone's beliefs are put to the test. Of course, it stars your boy Henrik Malberg, it stars my girl Birgit Federspiel, and it stars someone who I think we're a little divided on, Emil Haas Christensen. Now, of course, crowd favorite Preben Lordorf Rye. Ah. Well, okay, I don't know anybody in this cast, but this is Odette. It's from 1955. It's by Carl Theodor Dreyer. He's probably best known for his films Vampyr and The Passion of Joan of Arc, which is really one of my favorite movies of all time, but I've never seen anything more than those two movies by Dreyer, so I'm very excited to see this very intense, religious fucking movie from a Danish dude.
That's a good summary.
I think it's a good summary. It's all I got to go on right now. Again, I haven't seen the film.
All right.
So, oh, shit. Let me look up where it's available. Corky, if anyone wants to follow along at home, this movie is available on the Criterion channel. You know, we're big proponents of the Criterion channel. It's, you know, it's out there to run the physical media too somewhere, but do you want to watch it with us in 2 weeks? It's 125 minutes. It's actually slightly longer than Playtime, so this is the longest movie we've ever done, but I'm excited. Odette.
That's all we have for you on this week's show. Join us in 2 weeks when we'll be reviewing Odette. If you're interested in playing along at home, the movie is... Oh, you already said all that.
Yeah, it's all right to reiterate.
That's all we have for you on this week's show. Join us in 2 weeks when we'll be reviewing Odette. This Odette. Do you want this Odette? If you're interested in playing along at home, the movie, as Dan said, is available to watch on Criterion.
Criterion channel. In the meantime, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram for updates on the show. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you want to donate to the show and support this mission to finally bring Playtime to the 70mm screens at the Tower or, you know, some other place. It's the early stages of the plan. But if you like the plan, donating would help. All right? Do you like the plan? Tell 100 friends and donate. Tell them to donate. Yes, next thing you know, millions of people listen to the show.
Also, move to Sacramento. Make sure you're there to watch it. Whatever you got to do. This is our dream.
We really need to fill some seats here, okay? This, we got a lot riding on this.
I don't want to lose my ass on just screening a movie one time.
Oh, yeah. So donate for that, for Playtime, for everything. If you want to do that, go to daredaniel.com. Click the donate button, find support the show in the menu. There's ways to do it. You know what? If you see me on the street, just slip me $5.
He'll have his hat out.
It'll be out. It'll be busking. Out, trust me.
Dan, you still busk?
Do I busk?
Yeah, you got that busking routine?
From dawn till busk? Hell yeah.
All right, everybody. For Cannon Fodder, for Daniel Barnes, for me, for Jacques Titi, we're going to say see you later. And Dan, let him know.
Until next time. Save us a seat in the back row, except if it's playtime, and then I think we might want to be a little closer to the screen. There's a lot to take.
Center in. Seats.
Usually, back row, because we're probably smoking weed. Am I right?
Hey, playtime, that was right.
It's just, you know, because if I fall asleep, I don't want to deal with it. Until next, shit, did we already say until, is the show over?
I don't know.
Okay. Until the show's over, I'm Quirky McDonald. Show's over. Go home, everyone. Oops, what did I do? Okay, stop.